You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny spring day. It is April 3rd, and it is gorgeous outside, Don.
Sunny, mostly sunny, says the National Weather Service. It's been very pretty the last couple of days after a rather cool weekend and a rainy Friday and into Saturday last weekend. We've got had a warming trend, but things are going to change a little bit. Let's go through this week's weather. Today, Lois and I are preparing this for broadcast on April 3rd. It will broadcast on April 4, 2024. And today's high temperature is going to be 67 degrees with clearing tonight and 41 degrees as our low tonight. Chance of showers Thursday. Showers likely. The high on Thursday is only going to be 53 degrees. Thursday night, chance of showers, only 30% chance of showers, but the low Thursday night is going to be 40 degrees. This storm is pulling in some cold air with it and behind it. So for the next couple days this week, we've got a lingering feeling of winter. Friday is going to be mostly cloudy, slight chance of thunderstorms. We had a few of those last few days. 56 degrees is going to be the high on Friday. Friday night, this is the coldest one of this event, will be 38 degrees. Saturday, sunny, 60. So cold, but sunny. That'll be nice. Saturday night, partly cloudy, 41 degrees. Sunday, 61 degrees. So this is a 2 or 3 day chilly event. And then Sunday night, clearing up, 43. Monday, sunny, 70. Monday night, 46. Tuesday, 74. Looking over ahead at Weather Underground, where they go out a few more days, they're telling us it is going to be sunny on Tuesday and 77 with a low of 48, sunny on Wednesday and 78 with a low of 50, sunny on Thursday, high of 81, got that, with a low of 51 degrees on Thursday the 11th, and Friday will be 79 degrees with a low of 50 degrees. So the trajectory is where we want it next week. Okay, we've got an event we want to talk about.
Wait. You said you were going to tell me about the snowpack when we did the weather this morning, and I didn't hear that.
Oh, yes. The snowpack is measured on April 1st, and for the second year in a row, we are above average for April 1. And this was posted just a couple days ago, or yesterday, I believe, by the UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab. They have a snow lab way up there. And we are at, 124% of average in the Northern Sierra, at 107% of average in the Central Sierra, and at 101% of average in the Southern Sierra. So the three major monitoring networks, all above 100%, averaging to 110% of our April 1 average. The reason that they do this snow survey on April 1, we don't usually get a whole lot of storms after April 1 adding to it, so it's a good guide to how much snowpack is going to be there going into the summer. And that's our state's water reserve for the summer here. As that snow melts and continues to fill the reservoirs and go down to the cities and the farmers, they want to know at the start of the season how much is up there. Well, 110% of average. For the second year in a row, we're above 100%. Good news. After 10 years of drought, it's wonderful to see a good snowpack up there. So that's, if you want to follow along, that was UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab. I believe they're on the Twitter platform, and I believe you can also find them on Facebook, UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab, way up there by Donner somewhere. When I mentioned this one time, someone said Berkeley monitors snow. Yes, but not in Berkeley, elsewhere. Okay, Tree Davis has a big, big, big event coming up. This is our big Arbor Day event. Do you have that in front of you, Lois?
Yeah, what's Arbor Day? They're celebrating trees.
Trees, Arbor, yes.
Trees, plant, right?
Trees. Okay. And the traditional thing to do on Arbor Day is plant a tree. And usually Arbor Day in the rest of the country is sometime in April, and in California, because our season is earlier, we usually do it in March. But Tree Davis does it when we can get the people together and have a great big event. And so that is going to be this Saturday on April 6th, right? Let me make sure I have the calendar right. Is that April 6th?
That's 6th. Saturday is the 6th, yep.
Tree lovers of all ages are encouraged to join the City of Davis, Tree Davis, and the Davis Manor Neighborhood Association and Creative Action Team for an Arbor Day tree planting and festival. The day will kick off with a community tree planting throughout the Davis Manor neighborhood, which is East Davis, right near where my nursery is. That whole zone over there is Davis Manor. We'll be planting 30 trees.
Wow.
In front of neighbors' homes with volunteers and staff from the city and from Tree Davis. Then we'll have a festival at the N Street Park, which was recently planted by Tree Davis. N as in Nancy, N Street Park. At that festival, there will be exhibitors from the UC Davis Arboretum, from Cool Davis, from the City of Davis, from Tree Davis to share how everyone can improve our urban forest to ensure that our city is healthy and green. There will be activities for youngsters. I'm donating some seeds and pots for you all to plant some flower seeds. There'll be talks, tours, demonstrations to show what it takes to plant and care for trees in Davis. So starting at 9 o'clock, the tree planting, you can meet at N Street Park and they'll fan out from there and plant 30 trees around that neighborhood. At noon, there'll be a ceremonial tree planting with elected officials. 12:15, climate ready plants tour of the N Street Park. That's to just show people the understory plants that we, Tree Davis, have planted recently to help that landscape thrive. And then there'll be a mature tree pruning demonstration from 1 to 1:30 by West Coast Arborists. Should be very interesting. Lift trucks and everything. Chainsaws, come on out and watch them prune a tree properly. And then on 1:30, the Tree Davis staff will tell you how to water and care for your young tree. If you want to participate in the tree planting itself, go to treedavis.org and look at the event calendar and go ahead and register. Otherwise, wander on over to Davis Manor neighborhood in East Davis. N Street Park is where it will be the epicenter of it all. And that's Saturday, this coming Saturday, April 6th. So we'd love to see you there.
Unfortunately, April 6th has got a lot of stuff happening. And Don, if I can get there, I'm going to go to the African Violet.
Yes,
well, that's happening. It's on until 4 o'clock. So I may be able to do both. Go there, go Tree Davis in the morning and African Violets in the afternoon, or vice versa.
And the tree and the African Violet event is where?
Shepherd Garden Center, which is what's the name of that road?
It's on McKinley Boulevard.
Thank you,
McKinley Drive. Yeah, and easy to find. That's where almost all the garden clubs in Sacramento meet. I'm understanding is that if you really want to get the right African Violet, you probably should be there early.
Okay, so maybe I'll go there first and then come here. This is going to be my first outing in a long time.
Yeah,
and I'm very excited about it.
African violets are great houseplants. Yeah. The UC Davis upcoming sale, let me make sure to remind you that I believe it is Sunday and not Saturday this coming weekend. This is the first time that I can remember that they've done this. Yes, Sunday, April 7th, they'll be having their second sale for the season. Members only 9 o'clock. Public sale begins at 10. So a little bit of both. 1 hour for members to take advantage of the best selection. 3 hours for everyone to shop. Members always receive a discount. You can join and shop early and save. And the plant sale inventory is updated and online, including a photo gallery. But remember, if you show up on Saturday, there won't be anybody there. It's going to be Sunday, April 7th. Then Saturday, April 27th is the next Arboretum sale. Okay, we've got some great questions in the mailbag.
And before we get to those, I have a question for you. You sent me a gorgeous picture of a lilac. Oh, yeah. Thank you. The only problem with it is showed up on my phone as a text, but I can't smell it.
That's correct.
I love the scent of lilac.
I get a lot of people who don't believe lilacs can grow here for one reason or another.
But well, that's ridiculous.
Well, you don't see them as commonly here, obviously, as you do in Midwest and Mid-Atlantic states and New England and Canada, places where it actually gets cold in the winter. There's a widespread belief that they need a lot more winter chilling than we get, much as fruit trees need winter chilling.
I think it depends on which kind of lilac you get. I mean, some of them, they get so much mildew, they're almost not worth having. Mm-hmm. And other ones, they need more chilling than we get. But perhaps there's a lot of them that do great here.
There are hundreds of varieties of lilacs, if not more than that. And when we first moved here, I moved from a place where these deciduous flowering shrubs just didn't exist. Nobody planted spireas and lilacs and things in coastal San Diego, partly because of the lack of chilling there, but also they're just not part of that type of landscape. It's a subtropical climate. I mean, why would you bother? So I moved up here and I was enchanted by these. And I first planted a lilac on the east side of our garage at our very old house when we lived in town. East side, under an overhang, morning sun, frost protected. I should have put a bougainvillea there. That would have been the place for the subtropical plant that wanted to be warm in the winter. So it grew great and it never flowered because it was warm and sheltered, not the place for a lilac. But we buy this property out in the country, and right along the driveway are these flourishing lilacs. The present owner who we bought it from, you know, the current owner who we bought it from, did nothing for them. They don't need any care whatsoever, really. Planted probably 30, 40, 50 years prior by the original owner of the property. Just flourishing, doing fine with no special attention whatsoever. So I kept planting more, and I have actually several, and I have done very, very well with lilacs, including some that are said to need 800 or more chilling hours, as you might expect for fruit trees. Well, we get that here. We get that out in the country especially, but we get that here. So you will read, if you're listening to us in Southern California, that you need to go get certain lilac varieties, the Descanso hybrids, which will bloom with only a couple hundred chilling hours. And if you are listening in Southern California or the Bay Area of California or places that are similar to that, where it's a mild winter, you probably should look for the Descanso hybrids that were introduced by Descanso Gardens in Southern California. I have one of those. They're fragrant. They're not as fragrant as the older types, but they do fine here. But I've grown regular French hybrid lilacs, and they do extremely well. I sent Lois a picture of one that's in full bloom right now. This is the peak bloom for most of my lilacs, is generally early to mid-April. If you're going to use this as a phenological basis for planting your tomatoes, as I said earlier, I've had one that's been blooming for 2 weeks, and that would not have been suitable. So you'd have to choose a mid-season lilac, make that your example that you're going to go, aha, the lilacs are blooming. It is possibly time to consider planting my tomatoes. That would be a reasonable phenological basis. More to the point, this is one of those plants that comes into nurseries with a very frustrating label, because for whatever reason, the people who print the labels on these long ago started putting on the label that they are good for USDA zones 4 through 8, or 9, or zone 9. Yeah, this is on Spirea, it's on Forsythia, a lot of these deciduous flowering shrubs listed as zones 4 through 8. So to reiterate a pet peeve that longtime listeners have heard before, they should not put an upper limit on USDA zones. It's not how they work.
4 and up.
4 and up, yeah. And maybe it won't work in 10 or 11 or 12, that's quite possible, but for them to say 4 through 8 is inaccurate. Zones, all these deciduous flowering shrubs I mentioned do just fine here in zone 9, which is what we are, USDA zone 9. USDA zones are just a minimum temperature guide. They don't tell you about the upper temperature or the chilling hours or anything else. So I really don't know where this came from, but it's been going on for as long as I've been buying in lilacs, spireas, forsythias, weigelias, all those familiar deciduous flowering shrubs that people in colder climates know. You'll often read the label, 4 through 8, I guess it's not going to work here. Ask, because there's a high likelihood it will.
I want to clarify something here. When you say that it needs a certain amount of chilling hours, now when we're talking about fruit trees, it needs a certain amount of chilling hours to produce good fruit that year. Mm-hmm. So with the lilacs, a certain amount of chilling hours to produce lots of flowers, but it isn't going to kill the plant. It's not going to make the plant die. It's not, if we have one winter that is particularly light on chilling hours, well, maybe next winter we'll be back to what it needs.
Oh, it's happened. I've been tracking chilling hours here for 40 years, and I have a chart of them if anybody's interested. And the lowest we've ever been were twice when it got below 600 chilling hours. And on one of those years, it had a big impact on the apricot growers in the region because that was less chilling than those needed. What it does, the effect it would have if it were affecting the lilacs, for example, is the blossoms don't develop properly. The flower buds set, and then they don't open correctly. So if I have a particular apricot that needs more chilling than it gets, apparently. So it sets buds like crazy, and I look at it, and I go out, and I take pictures, and I think, this will be the year we finally get fruit on this haricot apricot, and then they don't open properly. So that's what happens. So if a lilac wasn't getting sufficient chilling, it wouldn't bloom. The blooms, it would bud but not bloom. That would be what you would see. Or if you're in between, it would prolong the bloom, and they wouldn't open real well. But they do fine. So this is something that folks in USDA Zone 9 should understand, at least in our version of USDA Zone 9, lilacs, and just for that matter, peonies, do grow just fine here. Now, lilacs want full sun for best results. That's why Lois is probably going to have problems with the one she planted. I have a lilac that has started in full sun, and as with much of my property, it's now in a lot of shade because I planted trees in that area, and it's growing fine. It's about 8 by 8. It's in full bloom right now. It smells great. It looks great. It does very, very well. It does get sun a couple hours in the morning, and then it's fully shaded in the summertime all the rest of the afternoon. It gets covered with powdery mildew. I mean, I would take, if I had a small yard, I would take it out because it looks so unsightly in the summer. But you know, it blooms just great. So they are best in full sun to reduce the mildew problem. I'm sure there are varietal differences with respect to powdery mildew, but I don't have any list of that. Full sun is best. You'll often read that lilacs prefer alkaline soil or limey soil. People will come in looking if they should get lime for their lilacs, and I'll think, well, welcome to Davis. I see you've moved here from east of the Mississippi. We don't have to worry about that here. This is a great place for lilacs because we have limey soil. We have limey water, so you don't have to worry about that. But it is one of those things where folks listening in places where the soil is naturally more acidic are often told to apply lime to their lilacs. Apparently, they like a higher pH than you all have in a lot of places. pH of our water is close to 8, and the pH of our soil is generally 7 or slightly higher. Lilacs do just great here and don't need any special attention whatsoever. The only thing is, they will get big. One of my lilacs is hitting about 12 feet after 7 or 8 years. So I'll probably go in to shorten it up to get those blooms back down to smelling level. What I do is I wait till they're done blooming. When they're all done blooming, I'll go ahead and cut it back probably 3 to 4 feet, that particular one, just for size control. And that's really the only pruning you need to bother with on lilacs at all. All right, we had a seed starting comment question there in the mailbox. Well,
we have a bunch of questions here. And did you want to, wait a minute. No, I've got heat mats. Yep. I'm going to do heat mats. Okay.
Yeah, that's the one.
So this is Mary from who lived in Davis and then moved to Folsom. So she's up in Folsom. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with our geography, Folsom is a little bit uphill.
Yep, a little colder. Yeah.
Yeah, a little cooler there. All right. So hello, Don and Lois. A friend recently introduced me to your podcast. I wish I'd known about your show long ago. We lived in Davis, and I could have used your expertise when planting our newly developed lot at Wild Horse. Oh, yeah. That's a subdivision that we have. We moved to Folsom 11 years ago, where I continue gardening. I like to start plants from seed, and I have a lovely glass greenhouse. Currently, the inside temperature has a minimum of 45 degrees and a maximum of 95 degrees with an oscillating fan timed to run 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. I use a heat mat to germinate seeds, leaving starts on the mat only until they have germinated, and then remove the plastic domes. It's recommended not to leave starts on the mat past germination. I'm wondering if I should leave the tomato and pepper starts on or near the mats to give them a bit more heat, particularly on chillier nights. Any seed starting tips are appreciated.
Yeah, let's deal with that first.
Pictures.
Yeah, and that is important. We've learned the hard way to leave peppers in particular on the warm mats for as much as a couple weeks after they germinate. The growers that I've talked with, commercial growers, keep their greenhouses at 80 degrees while they're germinating pepper and eggplant seeds, because that's what it requires. They usually use seed mats, and they keep the air temperature quite high, obviously by heating them directly. Now, this is an unheated, this is a passive greenhouse. And so people do need to understand passive greenhouses protect plants from freezing weather, but they are only a few degrees warmer than the outside temperature. I will never forget a customer moved here from the Bay Area, brought his orchid collection, bought a greenhouse, built it in the backyard, and called me in a panic because the night temperature in his greenhouse in November had dropped to 55 degrees and his tropical orchids couldn't take that. And I said, yeah, heated greenhouses are the only way you're going to grow tropical orchids here. They probably should come inside before they get irreparable damage from those temperatures. And we're not talking about that kind of damage with peppers and eggplant, but the seeds will stall. I mean, we have this experience ourselves. One, pepper seeds take at least 2 to 3 weeks to germinate, sometimes faster on bottom heat, but can be as much as 2 to 3 weeks. And if you don't keep them on that heat until the first true leaves start to push out, at least, they'll just sit there. So our experience has been, one, heat mats are the key to successfully germinating your own peppers and eggplant. They really need warm bottom heat. Tomatoes are tougher plants, but still benefit from it. Tomatoes, we get off there as soon as they break to the ground. They move off there, although they're still in a warm place. They're still indoors if the nights are cold. They go into the greenhouse as soon as possible, because the greenhouse, like yours, is going to get really warm on a sunny day, so that's great. But the nights are still kind of chilly. Well, tomatoes, they seem to manage that, but peppers and eggplant, definitely not. So to your very specific question about peppers and eggplant, I would say yes, leave them on the mat if you have the room until you start to see those first true leaves, not the seedling leaves, but the first true leaves pushing out. Then you're probably fine to take them off of there. Unless, of course, we rapidly start to warm up and your greenhouse is staying warm enough at night, which could happen as any time in April. So.
And when you have those. So what I'm hearing from you years ago was to take your seedlings into the house at night, into the home, inside, not in a greenhouse, but inside.
How cold it is,
but yeah. It doesn't get too cold. And then take them out in the daytime. Now, is that true in a greenhouse?
If you have the bottom heat, it's not necessary. So if you were at our greenhouse, we germinate things in our office because that's where we have the light and the heat mat set up. We also have heat mats set up right outside the building. If you're at my nursery, Redwood Barn, you can poke your head around the side and you'll see the operation there. We also have a mist bench on the side of the building there. And so that keeps at least the soil under them warm and the building is trapping heat. And we find that's adequate for most things. It really depends on how cold we get. And with peppers at home, because I don't have all that set up at my house, yes, they go outside on a sunny morning. They're sitting on the front porch right now. They come back in as soon as I get home. And that's because the nights are too cold for them. But the bottom heat makes a big, big difference. That really has been the key to successfully growing peppers from seed for us, for commercial purposes, and for my own garden. I did an experiment this year. I do a lot of hatch peppers. That's my favorite pepper for processing late in the season. I planted them in a normal way, without any heat pad, here in my house 2.5 weeks ago, and they're just beginning to sprout. So 2.5 weeks, they're finally beginning to push out. And that's kind of what happens when you do it without the bottom heat and where you're just finding like the warmest place you can. Bottom heat is consistent. So that makes a big difference in terms of reliable germination and development of the young peppers.
And Mary Kay continues with her message. Peppers I started 2 weeks before are peppers were started 2 weeks before starting tomatoes.
Yep.
Okay, one lesson I forgot is to start broccoli, cauliflower, and Romanescu in separate start trays from my peppers.
Yes, indeed.
The brassica would appreciate cooler temperatures while the peppers want warmer temperatures. I could cut up the cells, but I prefer to keep the trays intact for reuse. Thank you for your good advice.
Yeah, anything in the brassica group, all the ones you mentioned, broccoli, cauliflower, Romanesco, kale, all that kind of, they germinate very rapidly. They're, of course, much more tolerant of cool conditions. They can come up in as little as 5 to 7 days, and they're going to outgrow the flat that the peppers are in, so you may end up having to sacrifice those trays. Also, down here in the valley, we wouldn't be planting those now. Broccoli, cauliflower, Romanesco are all planted in the fall and into the midwinter. Last planting of those out in the garden here is typically February to early to mid-March. And then it's a race against time against the heat that comes in that causes them to become unpalatable or to simply bolt and flower. So we don't normally have this problem, but there's a lot of places where people are planting cool season things and warm season things at the same time. I mean, I'm always surprised when I see a garden that has broccoli, lettuce, and tomatoes in it, because we would never do that here. But there are places where you're planting those things, I guess, for the early season, and then the others are going to fill in after it gets warmer. Yes, anything in the broccoli group is very fast to germinate and very fast to grow. We found when we try to do those under lights and indoors, we got to move them out as soon as they break the soil, and we move them outside if we possibly can, even though we're again typically talking about late fall to winter, because the air movement helps you get a sturdier, stockier plant, and they stretch really fast. So it is a plant that you'll typically want to get out of those indoor conditions and out to at least good air movement as quickly as possible. But note, one of the first things she mentioned, she has an oscillating fan. Fans are really, really important in greenhouse production and extremely important in seed germination. The worst enemy that gardeners have in a greenhouse setting is the damping off diseases, Pythium, Phytophthora, Rhizoctonia, which we call damping off diseases, that attack the seedlings. The best strategy against them is air movement. Don't overcrowd the seedlings and put them where there'll be airflow. In greenhouse management, there's highly technical levels of air exchange that are mandated for greenhouses of certain cubic volume and so forth. Greenhouse managers know that they have to keep the air circulating and moving. Home operation, you can do something as simple as what we've done. You know those little fans that'll plug into your computer? Little tiny fan? Yeah, that's perfect. Set that up somewhere a few feet away from your seed tray. Don't let it dry anything out. It's got to be far enough away that it's not going to be constantly drying one little batch of seedlings. And turn that on for at least a couple hours during the daytime. And that can make a big difference in the likelihood of getting damping off disease. It's a very low energy input. Makes a big, big difference. Airflow and natural sunlight are your best natural disease prevention.
So I have a question about this heating pad that you're putting underneath the tray. If I were to take that have a table and take that heating pad and next to it put a rack, like a kitchen rack, so that that's the same level. And then I could put my tray of seeds so that half of it was on the heater, and that'd be the pepper side, and part of it was off the heater. And would that make any difference to those brassicas?
Yeah, some. I mean, the benefit of the heat pad is right under the pot, and a few inches up is not going to be as warm, although you will find when you have lights and a heat pad and all that stuff going on, that room gets a little warm and humid. So be aware of that. So this is something to do carefully. We learned long ago that as much of it as we could do outside and in the greenhouse, the better, because of the natural air circulation, natural light. But we watch those night temperatures really carefully, and the heating pads are just your insurance against any sudden drop in temperature, such as we're going to have later this week. You know, 38 degrees on Friday morning, if your little seed are outside and you've just moved them out, that would not be good for them. They can harden up. Plants do harden. It's a physiological phenomenon that occurs with repeated exposure to lower temperatures. I saw someone on a Facebook group, I posted a thing about the upcoming weather, and her answer was survival of the fittest. Well, that's fine. You know, there's a lot of people that start way more tomato seedlings than they need, so they probably have enough to play around with anyway. In fact, that's one of the most common conversations in online Facebook group. Hey, I have 59 tomato seedlings and I need 6 plants. Anybody want to trade? So there's lots and lots of those seedling exchanges going on in Davis right now.
So thanks to Mary Kay for sending us this message. And I hope that you will continue to let us know what's going on. Please write to us again. Give us another photo in a couple of weeks. And
this is a great picture of a greenhouse, and I'm very jealous, actually. I think a lot of people would love to have a greenhouse like this. So.
Right. Well, let's go on. We've got lots more to talk about. And the next thing I want to talk about is Don is doing some seed plantings. And he's got a list here. Plants we've tested to grow from seed to see how easy they are from seed, how long, how much they bloom, how they, quote, finish, unquote. If they've fallen out of popularity, what might be the reason? So tell us about these seeds that you grew.
We have been, for 4 or 5 years now, one of my staff and I in particular have been very interested to figure out why certain plants fell out of favor or just aren't in the industry at all, and whether there were versions of those plants that we could grow that might bring them back into popularity. I would say our most successful version of that we've come up with is the old-fashioned, very large flowered zinnias, the Benary series of zinnias, which we've been growing ourselves now to sell. And we've got people that are on a list each year who want us to tell them when they're ready because they're so successful, but you just never see them in nursery packs or even in 4-inch pots at garden centers. So we were kind of curious about this. What is the hang up? I've had a theory myself after a long time in business that a big part of it is that a lot of these plants don't lend themselves to the bedding plant industry. You know, they need to have plants that are a particular growth habit. They need to be tight. It's best if they bloom in the pack and so forth. I mean, they want a particular set of characteristics that old-fashioned flowers just don't really meet. And the Benary series is one example of a plant that gets 4 feet tall and gives you 50 blooms on each plant, and each one of them's on a stem that you can cut, and they're an amazing garden plant, but you're not likely to find those in garden centers. And there you just aren't. They're not the kind of thing that's going to fit well in a bedding plant program. So I sent you this list, and this is just a short version. There's a lot of different ones we've been testing. Go ahead and read a couple of the first ones on there.
Well, you already said zinnias, and then snapdragons. Now, there are snapdragons in the bedding plant, but are you Absolutely. Talking bigger ones?
Yeah, the old-fashioned cutting snapdragons, you know, the ones that were grown heavily in the middle of the 20th century. This is a plant that has a photoperiod reaction, meaning it blooms in response to a particular set of hours of darkness, and so they would grow and bloom at a particular time of year. That's changed with the introduction of day-neutral snapdragons and shorter, compact snapdragons, which are great plants. If you want to see an amazing display right now, right in front of my nursery, we planted a whole long row of these very miniature, they're called snap teeny snap teeny snap dragons. Isn't that cute? And they're about a foot tall. Each one makes a little mound of flowers. It's been blooming since November, December. They're coming into peak bloom now. They'll be going on for another 2 months, probably make it through the summer. If we left them there, we'll probably pull them out because something else will go in, but they can make it through the summer. And they give a lot of bloom, and they sell great in packs and in 4-inch pots. And they're even in bloom in 4-inch pots, which right there is the gold standard for the bedding plant industry. Blooms in a pot, hey, that's the variety we want. There's also a whole bunch that bloom at about 16 to 18 inches, but still stay sort of freestanding. So they're nice compact plants. So you can buy those. And we've got a few of those blooming out there as well. We sell those in the fall or the late winter for bloom in the spring and into the early summer. But those will bloom at about, you know, a foot and a half tall. Old fashioned snapdragons bloom 3 feet tall. They have blooms that are a foot and a half long. They are great for cutting. That was actually the origin of snapdragons as a crop in the US, was for cut flowers. And those are great to grow, but we have found they take a very long time to get to saleable size. And you plant them this year, they might not bloom until next year. That's just something to be aware of. So give them some space and you will be amply rewarded. And in our climate, remember, we're USDA zone 9, sunset zone 14, comparable to sunset zones 8 and 9. I have found snapdragons go 2, 3, 4 years. I have one in my backyard that's in a 15-gallon pot because that's what I put it in. It's 4 years old, and it's just about to come into bloom at about 4 feet tall. This is one of the old-fashioned cutting snapdragons. If you're into cut flowers and you want something that attracts butterflies and you want something that has a long bloom season, consider looking for the seed, because that's the only way you're going to get them, of some of these old-fashioned snapdragons, the UC hybrids or some of the others that have been out there for a long time, Rocket, Tetra series. There's a bunch of them that were very popular 50 years ago, but have fallen out of the trade simply because more compact, earlier blooming types became more popular with the growers.
Well, I hope you're taking pictures of all of these things, because I would love to see that row of snapdragons outside your place.
Well, these are the way I just to give a little background, the way I test these is I use 15-gallon nursery pots, because I have a lot of those, and I fill them with a good soil, one of our better soils that we sell that's enriched, and I think that makes a big difference. And I put in what seems like a reasonable number for that plant in that size container. So I'm doing them the equivalent of a raised planter bed, and I've done some of them in raised planters as well. I want to grow them under optimum conditions and see what works. So in the case of an old-fashioned snapdragon, yeah, three of them are in a 15-gallon container, and that's that. But these newer ones you can crowd more closely if you want. The key is I do enriched soil. These are all flowers that benefit from a little coddling, a little bit of, you know, pushing with fertilizer if you happen to prefer to use that method. I just use an enriched soil that already has the fertilizer in it. Full sun for the plants that prefer that. You know, I try to find just the right place for them, and then I let them grow to their absolute optimum. And I want to see also if there's some reason that people maybe found them a hassle. Sweet peas are a really good example. We'll do them next. Sweet peas are a cool season flower. They love 55 to 80 degrees, as don't we all? They'd rather be on the coast of Oregon or in the sunnier parts of England. And they do love our climate in the spring and in the fall. So here we plant sweet peas in the fall. They grow up. They're okay going into the winter. As soon as we get past the coldest, dreariest part of winter, they bolt, they run. Even the shortest types get 3 to 4 feet. Others can get 5 to 6 feet. They start blooming as early as February into March, and then they bloom all the way until it gets into the upper 80s to 90 degree range, and then they start looking kind of rough. Two things about sweet peas: they need something to climb on. It doesn't have to be sturdy. It can be a very light structure, but you do need to plan for where they're going to go. So maybe that's a factor. And then their finish isn't great. So this is something I've realized might be a factor for some. They kind of look awful when it starts to get hot, and they look withered. And so it's time to pull them out, by which time they have seeded and scattered their seed all over the place. So it's one of those plants that you typically only need to plant once because they will reseed very happily. But there are dwarf types out there. There's some bush forms of sweet peas that only get 2 to 3 feet tall. There's even some that kind of cascade, which are basically just even shorter types you could do in containers. They have that amazing fragrance. They do differ somewhat in how fragrant they are, but they're all fragrant. Some of them are powerfully fragrant. In fact, I've learned that, like paper whites and star jasmine, there's some people who find them a little overwhelming, who don't like the fragrance of sweet peas. Be aware of that. Perhaps someone in your household doesn't want you to bring them into the house. But in general, I think the reason they fell out of favor is you had to plan ahead. And when they are past their peak, they're a little rough. They also are very fragile seedlings. So that's probably another factor.
You have something here listed, cornflower. What's a cornflower? It certainly isn't a corn.
Cornflower is bachelor buttons, and it's a centaury. It's a very, very easy flower to grow. We've been extremely impressed by them, actually. And overall, everything in that group has been quite impressive. Cornflower is something you can buy at garden centers. They've come back in. They kind of came and went, and they're back again because there's true blue and burgundy colors. And that's an easy one. It just will take probably a full season to bloom. If you plant them early enough in the spring, they'll bloom this year. It's one of those plants that more typically you plant in the fall for spring bloom here. It differs in different climates, but we've been very impressed with them.
And then you have Nicotiana.
Nicotiana. I've heard it pronounced Nicotiana, Nicotiana. It's flowering nicotine, flowering tobacco. That, for bang for your buck, we are overwhelmingly impressed with Nicotiana. Bear in mind, it's nicotine, it's a tobacco plant, it's poisonous. So, you know, if that's an issue in your household, be aware of it. But so far, every variety of Nicotiana that we've grown from seed has been easy to germinate. You can plant them in the spring or the fall. They go through the winter just fine. I have pictures of them in bloom every season of the year. I have them in bloom right now, massive bloom. They look spectacular from plants I put in more than 2 years ago. There are dwarf types that only get a foot or so. Those are the Nikki series, which are very popular in the bedding plant industry. The old fashioned Nicotiana sylvestris, which is this giant 4 foot tall thing that reseeds all over your yard. That's a super fragrant one. There's a whole lot that are in between, 3 foot, 4 foot range in bloom, and they will reseed. So one issue with that plant is that perhaps it fell out of favor simply because it is one of those plants that will, let's say, naturalize in your yard. Hummingbirds love them. Sphinx moths absolutely love them. The hawk moths. They're one of those things that blooms heavily in the evening, the fragrance is heaviest in the evening. So you're walking by, you get that very sweet scent that they have. I have them in full sun. They're fine. I've had them seed into light shade. They're fine there. Great in pots. The nearby the pots is also good. So again, this is a plant that will reseed itself somewhat. But in terms of the number of different things we've planted that have given the longest bloom with the least input, Nicotiana is one of the best. And it's really it just fell out of favor years ago. I don't know why. Perhaps all those things I mentioned, like reseeding and the fact that it is poisonous. I don't know how readily one could poison oneself with it, but it is toxic, so be aware of that. But the bloom is amazing, and it blooms pretty much every season. So that's one, if you haven't grown it for a while and you really like to draw the evening moths and the hummingbirds and stuff, it's really a great choice. And so far, we've been impressed by all of them. There's a really cool one out there that's green. So if you're into green flowers, there's a green flowered Nicotiana that is just beautiful. It's really a shade of yellow with a tinge of green, really stands out. I highly recommend that one. It's kind of a lime green color. And then there's all the others are mostly red, pink, white, very, very easy to grow.
So the next thing you had, it says they did well, but had issues. You talked about the sweet peas already. What are old fashioned large flowers, marigolds? What's wrong with them?
They fall apart and they get spider mites and thrips. Wow. So I grow marigolds every year because I really like them. They're just one of my favorite flowers to grow. And as far as I'm concerned, they're a plant that you start the seed now, March, April into May. They grow great and they bloom June, July into early August. In our climate, spider mites and thrips will both show up in August and the foliage will look really, really rough. I can't imagine spraying marigolds to kill spider mites and thrips. That just doesn't seem like a reasonable use of a pesticide. So I found that they sort of run their course, but by mid to late August, I think the plants are looking really, really scruffy. And so I cut them back and sometimes they resprout. More to the point, I just plant new ones. And that seems to be another option as you get nice new healthy plants growing. They'll bloom for a while. We've been trying for years to grow marigolds for Dia de los Muertos, which is the holiday fall, you know, around Halloween, that's become a big deal in California. Big old-fashioned marigolds are a staple for that. And we've tried and tried, and I can tell you something, that's a high pesticide crop if you're thinking of growing it for the market, because you've got to have the flowers looking perfect and the foliage looking perfect. And so we don't want to bother with that. But they are easy to grow. They're very easy anywhere you have a good sunny, warm climate. And just bear in mind that in drier places like the Sacramento Valley, they're going to look rough by mid to late August. You know, if you can get used to the idea that some plants peak out and you just cut them down at that point, don't have them limp along all season looking worse and worse, and then put in something else, then you'll be happy with them. But my experience with marigolds is they can look pretty rough by about mid to late summer on. On the other hand, zinnias look great all the way up till frost. And cosmos, which is a nice alternative to zinnias and marigolds, same group, same basic beneficial insects that are drawn to it, they start looking really good right about when the marigolds are peeking out. So plant cosmos with your marigolds in a great big bed. When the marigolds start to look rough, cut them down. The cosmos will happily fill in, and they bloom best here in the late summer and fall. They're just a little slow to get going. So I think that may be why cosmos have sort of fallen out of favor. Plus, they're ferny, feathery, thin foliage, so they don't look great in a pack or a small pot, but they're one of the easiest flowers to grow. So hey, for those of you that want to plant flowers among your vegetables, I always did marigolds because my dad always did marigolds. Gradually, I shifted over to zinnias and cosmos because I just find them more satisfactory out in the vegetable garden. They're also great plants for the valley.
So the kind of plant that a cosmos and a marigold are they daisies or are they some other kind of thing?
Yeah, they're daisies, and everything in the daisy family is extremely attractive to beneficials of all kinds. It's one of the best groups of plants you can plant. You want to draw hummingbirds? Plant some daisies. I know that doesn't sound intuitive because it's not the kind of flower that we tell you should attract hummingbirds, but they do. It's a collection, a daisy is a composite, hence the name, old name, compositae for the family, of little tiny tubular flowers with the more showy ray flowers around the edge of the inflorescence, which are sterile, but which are used to draw pollinators. A sunflower is a classic example of a daisy. And when we first moved to our property, it was sugar beets and giant trees, so we didn't have very many birds here. So I planted a row of sunflowers just for fun. Next thing I knew, hummingbirds were showing up. Going up to each sunflower inflorescence and spending, you know, a minute there going to one little tubular flower after another, because that's what it is. It's a series of little tiny tubular flowers. All the daisies are like that. You will find hummingbirds, butterflies, hoverflies, which their larvae feed on aphids, all kinds of little beetles come in. There's lots of food sources in those daisy composite flowers. So it's one of the very best groups of plants you can plant if you want to draw beneficial insects and others into your garden.
Are dianthus also daisy?
No, they're in the carnation family. They're different. They're very attractive to hummingbirds, for sure. Dianthus are a tubular flower. They're just a flattened tube, and I have to assume there's a nectar reward in there because I certainly see hummingbirds going to dianthus flowers. If you want to draw the beneficials like butterflies, which are very attracted to dianthus, pinks is the common name for dianthus, or hummingbirds, do the old-fashioned single ones rather than the very heavily doubled ones, just because if you watch a butterfly go up to a carnation,
It's hard to get in there.
A little trouble figuring out where to poke that proboscis. Yeah, it seems to just make it more difficult for them. They'll try, let me tell you. But if you have a old-fashioned single-flowered dianthus, of which there are many, many, many cultivars out there, super fragrant, wonderful fragrance on those are going to be better probably for the hummingbirds and for the butterflies. Dianthus is actually one of my favorite plant groups, and I love to grow them from seed, but they are time-consuming. So if you are someone that wants to grow something and has fun growing things from seed, certainly try some of the old-fashioned or even modern dianthus. That one lends itself very well to the bedding plant industry, so you'll find all kinds of them in garden centers typically coming into bloom right there in those six packs or in those single pots. They're a very easy plant for us to grow in the drier parts of the West because they love sun and they don't get the disease problems here that they get in rainier climates. So dianthus is a great one, but that's one you can find in garden centers. So.
And then you have three that says great but narrow bloom period. So yeah. Tell me about stock.
Stock is a wonderful, fragrant flower, very old-fashioned, that is planted in the late summer for bloom in the fall and into the winter. It again tends to bloom in the late winter, and then it's done. So it is a narrow bloom period here in California, but it's worth it. It's a winter blooming annual. The plant itself is not robust. It's not a giant plant with substance, but the flowers have this amazing, very recognizable sweet fragrance, very similar in some ways to dianthus, same group of volatile compounds. And the key is the timing on that one. The later you plant them, and this is also one where I do fault the bedding plant industry, the later you plant them, the more you're just going to get bloom on a little plant. And that's it. You're not going to get much more. Early planted stock, August to September, will make a bunch of basal shoots. And then when it gets its trigger to bloom right after the solstice, will start to bloom a whole bunch of shoots on an individual plant. Late planted stock will get that trigger and just bloom one shoot. So you won't get as much flower out of it. And the bedding plant industry has gone almost entirely to one very dwarf strain that blooms at about 6 or 8 inches tall. Yeah, it's fragrant, but they're usually blooming when you buy them. And that it's one of the, not just one and done. It's almost done when you buy it. Frustrates the heck out of me. So to me, if you want to grow stock and really appreciate them, start your own seed, purchase it in late summer, start the seed in late summer, early fall, get the plants growing nicely, probably keep them in partial shade, so, you know, in the containers, because it'll be hard to keep them watered otherwise. They do like full sun when they're growing, and plant them out as early in your fall as you can if you're listening in a place where that's appropriate. And if you have the inclination and you really want one of the most fragrant plants in the world, look for the evening scented stock, which is a different species. And it's not very dense. It's a fairly thin looking plant, but it'll make your eyes water. It's that kind of fragrance. It's powerfully fragrant. Only in the evening, right as the sun is going down, you'll be walking through your garden going, where the heck is that fragrance coming from? It's like the Lady Banks rose. It drifts off many, many, many feet from the plant. Definitely worth growing. And you're not going to find that in most garden centers. You're going to need to start that seed yourself, because the plant itself is not what I'd call super attractive. This is where you have a nice deep border, right? Everybody has a nice deep flower border that you maintain meticulously. Well, put it towards the back of that border, because you need more plants of more substance with it, but it's definitely worth growing.
So, Don, I hope you have on your schedule in August to plant out these plants, but then you'd have to have on your schedule when to seed them too.
July to August, yeah.
Yeah, you write that down and remind us, okay?
A lot of these are very easy from seed. The reason I mention this now is that many of the things, like Nicotiana is a good example, marigolds, you can start them now from seed. Zinnias, we'll be starting our zinnias a little bit later this month to sell in late May. They come up very quickly. They need warm conditions both to germinate and grow. Very, very easy from seed. So people ask me, well, how about if I just put the seed out in the ground? Generally speaking, direct seeding is much, much, much less successful than starting things in pots to transplant them out later. That's been my experience and that of most of my customers. When you scatter seed, you feel like you're just sort of flinging dollar bills away. you're just inviting the sparrows and the other animals. You're telling the snails, check over here in 5 days. There'll be some nice buffet for you. Too many things like seedlings, too many problems with seedlings, with keeping them watered and so on. So generally, my experience at least, and most of the longtime gardeners I know, is if you really want something, start it in pots, get into the habit of starting them in little trays and moving them up to whatever pot you're going to grow them up in, then plant them out. And you learn over time which things need more coddling and nurturing, which things go very quickly. Zinnias, planted in late April from seed, will be something you can transplant out into your garden as little as 3 or 4 weeks later. They come up very quickly when the weather is warm. They grow very rapidly. You could probably transplant them out by Memorial Day weekend. You might only need to transplant them once from the seedling tray into a 3-inch or 4-inch pot. Other things like peppers, we've talked about so many times, take weeks and weeks and weeks to really get to that transplanting stage. So some things should be direct seeded. California poppy is a good example. Best to do them directly in the ground. Many others, seeding them first into a tray or into a pot and then transplanting them out as soon as you can. And something you learn when you're doing things from seed is pick one up every now and then, flip it over, slide the pot off. Most of the soil will stay intact. See where the roots are. When the roots are hitting the bottom and beginning to circle, it's really important to keep things moving, keep things transplanting. Don't keep it in a small pot, getting more and more root bound as you wait for the soil conditions to get suitable. If it's going to be a couple to a few weeks before it goes in the ground, it's worth the effort to take it from that little tray or that little pot up to the next size. We're beginning to find the quart pot, as they call it in our business. It's a little bigger than a 4-inch pot. It's really ideal for a lot of these things. And don't scrimp on potting soil. Get a good quality potting soil. You want to get these seedlings off to the best start you can. You'll just get much more satisfactory results. Starting seeds yourself is challenging, but once you get the hang of it, you have a good place for it, a little greenhouse or a side of the house that's a little more sheltered, it can actually be very satisfying. You just learn that every plant is different as to how quickly it grows. There are plants we haven't successfully grown from seed for sale. Lupins are a good example. And we've been trying to figure out how to grow lupins for sale. Their roots go straight down right away. I mean, we've done native lupins and garden lupins, and what you end up with is a taproot that hits the bottom of the pot in no time. It isn't even branching, and they're very fragile. So we have found at our garden center, they're very challenging to grow for sale. We're going to work on that. We're going to figure this out somehow, but some flowers are just easier than others. Most of the ones I've mentioned, very, very easy from seed, and best to do in small pots and then transplant out later.
Oh, I have so many questions, Don. I think I'm going to have to hold them until another show, because I want to get through this list. And I've got a couple more. A narrow bloom period comment. Night phlox and China aster
China aster is what a lot of people are thinking of when they say aster. Asters are perennials, and they're cool plants. There's even California native asters. They're great for your garden for their late summer and early fall bloom, and they're a lot like chrysanthemums in their bloom cycle. They're herbaceous perennials. But China asters are a whole series of annuals that look and grow a lot like zinnias, but a different color range. There's true blue, for example, in China asters. They're thinner plants. They're not as robust looking as a zinnia, but they combine very, very well with them. My experience is they started blooming later than the zinnias for me. They don't give as much bloom as the zinnias, but they're very pretty and very elegant. And if you have a smaller garden, these old-fashioned zinnias, I'm talking about Benary Giant, a single plant of Benary Giant, which I grew in my vegetable garden on its own drip emitter last year, got 4x4. Okay, it's like a shrub with zinnia flowers, so that was really cool, but it's a big plant. If you don't have that kind of space, you might find China asters more suitable. They have a really pretty color range, they cut beautifully, they're very attractive, elegant flowers, and they just start a little bit later and stop a little bit earlier than the zinnias, but they still give that same late summer into the fall bloom. So China aster is the name you're looking for on those. Quite easy from seed. Don't bother planting the seed until the soil has warmed up, so probably 1st of May for direct seeding those, or starting them in pots later in April.
And night phlox? What is night phlox?
Zeluzianskia, that's it. It's a Zeluzianskia is a plant from the Cape of South Africa, so it's Zeluzianskia capensis. I think I got that name right. I should look it up and make sure. It is this incredibly cool, funny little plant. We have tried and tried to sell this plant, but it's got one problem. The flowers only open after dark. So at a garden center, that's a problem. We're not open in the evening.
Okay. Yeah, you have to put a picture with a sign, and it's like, this is what it'll do tonight.
Apparently, this covers dry meadow areas in the Cape of South Africa. It's this funny little plant. It gets about a foot. I urge you, if you're into fragrant plants, to look for this plant, because it is, again, as powerfully fragrant almost as that evening scented stock. Why is it that plants that bloom in the evening and at night have such powerful fragrance?
Because of the moths.
Right. They're trying to draw pollinators that may be flying by and can't even see the blossoms. Well, these are, it's a cute little flower. It's balled up tight during the daytime. About dusk, it opens and you're walking by and going, it smells like spice cake. Someone is baking spice cake. That's exactly what it smells like. Clove, cinnamon is all in there. And it's this little plant, insignificant plant, maybe 8 inches tall, and it's blooming away merrily and casting off its volatile organic compounds to try to draw pollinators. And it does successfully draw them. It's actually quite easy to grow, but you're not going to find it in any garden center. I can tell you about that. As we know why, but it is something that you will find actually quite easy for the cool season. We have grown it, generally speaking, starting late summer along with stock, and it blooms in the late winter into the spring.
Now, the other thing that you have on this list are two things, and the title is Not So Great. Not So Great. And we have Canterbury Bells and Nasturtium. Now, Nasturtium, come on, Don. Nasturtium is so easy to grow. Why would you say it's not so great?
The issue with nasturtiums, actually, they're fine. They're great garden plants. We have found that they germinate very easily. Mm-hmm. They outgrow the pot very quickly. So when we're growing them for sale, and the wholesalers we buy them from are growing them for sale, they put them right in the pot they're going to sell them in, unlike most things where they'll start them in seedling trays and transplant them out. As soon as they're up and have their first set of leaves, they ship them out. So literally like 10 days after they've seeded them. And very quickly, they get root bound in those little pots. So as a bedding plant, they're a challenge. And for people to do themselves can be a bit of a challenge. You need to monitor them and get them out very quickly. People listening in coastal areas may be thinking, really, you're going to be planting nasturtiums? They're all over my yard. Yeah, there are places where they can become, let's say, garden thugs. Here, they love our spring and they love our fall. They're not thrilled about our summers, and the winters can be rough. So we're just on the edge. Again, they're one of those plants, like most of us, it prefers to be 55 to 80 degrees all the time. And so they do very well, and they look great right now. They're in full bloom in my yard. And they're from seeds that I just stuck right into big planters in, I think it was October. And they came up very nicely, and they made it through the winter, which they usually make it through, but they can look a little bit rough here in our climate. And then they just take off in the spring, and they bloom. As soon as we get into the upper 80s to 90s, the foliage can look very rough. But the nicest stands of nasturtiums that I've seen typically here in the Sacramento Valley are where they have a little bit of increasing shade as the season goes along, where maybe a deciduous tree is giving them some shade. The foliage foliage is very attractive. They're extremely easy to grow. They're a great one for a kid's planting project because they'll germinate very rapidly. The foliage is cool, so they look interesting even if they don't bloom. But in this climate, they need to be a little bit sheltered from extreme heat, and they can be damaged by colder than average temperatures. So they're a spring and a fall plant, very easy to grow. Again, don't lend themselves to bedding plant sales, but there's something you can plant, and you're doing a project with kids, you know, where they're saving yogurt cups and sticking seeds in them. Nasturtiums are foolproof as far as that goes. Just get them planted out of those things as quickly as you can.
So, yeah, okay, a couple of questions about nasturtiums. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that you can do what I did, which is to just go out and take a pencil and stick it in the ground and make a hole and drop the seed in, and that's that's planting a nasturtium seed. Yeah. And can I do that any time of the year except during a heat wave?
Pretty much. They will germinate almost any time. You know, freezing cold weather may not be perfect, but they'll probably just hang out in the soil and wait. Now, as far as that goes, yes, this is one where direct seeding it is fine. Not much seems to eat nasturtiums in any form. Yeah. Actually, the foliage is not attractive to... in fact, this is an interesting thing that I read in Organic Gardening years ago, and it appears to be true. The cabbage moths are attracted to the plants and oviposit on them, and the eggs hatch, and the larva can't feed on the leaves, so they die. So people use nasturtiums as a trap crop between their broccoli and cauliflower plants. And that appears to has some validity, actually. Yeah.
Well, there are things that eat nasturtiums because people eat nasturtium flowers in their salads.
Yeah,
and they're very tasty, a little spicy thing there.
Yeah, they're an edible flower, and they have a slightly skunky smell that perhaps is unappealing to herbivores of other types. But they're easy. They're just not something that that lends themselves to seed production. You should do them yourself, and it is one where you can direct seed them without much difficulty.
Are all of these annuals? Are there any nasturtium that are perennial?
Well, they function as perennials in our milder climates. I've had plants go 2 to 3 years, and many of these things we've been talking about, like the Nicotiana and some of the others, will continue for a couple of years. That's a different category than the ones that wait a couple of years to bloom, which brings you to the next one on your list.
Canterbury bells.
Yeah, we keep trying, and they grow, they sprout easily, and then they sit and sit and sit, and this drives bedding plant growers crazy. And then you finally have this thing that you plant. And I did this, and I put them into a great big container. I gave this whole container to Canterbury bells because I really like them. And they filled out really nicely, and they grew for another year. And then they filled out really nicely and grew for another year. And the third year, they bloomed. And it was spectacular for about 4 weeks. and that was that. Okay, so... in terms of, as we like to say, bang for your buck, it's probably not your best choice, but they are beautiful. It's just a fairly short window of bloom on those. It was sort of startling to me how it was only 3 or 4 weeks, although admittedly I have many pictures of it when it was in bloom because they were quite striking. It put a lot of energy into that bloom after having waited 3 years to finally do it.
It sounds like another one of those things that looks really nice in an English country garden.
Right. In the border, in the 12-foot deep border that we were talking about earlier, where you have a lot of other things blooming and all of a sudden it pops into bloom back there. When it's done, you cut it back and sometimes it comes back. So we just found them challenging, but they are very pretty and they bloom in a fair bit of shade. So that's another of their positive attributes. As with foxglove, they'll bloom in quite a bit of shade and there aren't that many things that give you that kind of color in the shade.
And if you want to see what's blooming now, you can always go to Don's website, theredwoodbarn.com, and look for the calendar. And the April calendar has a whole bunch of stuff on it. I won't go through it this week, but this is only the first one of our April shows. So we'll come back to that in another week. But
you've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.